Okay, let's start. Okay, good morning, good evening, Japan. Japan must be on the line somewhere, no?
Or yes, good morning.
You're in Brussels, or is Filippo in Japan?
Yes.
Filippo is in Japan.
Yes, correct.
Oh, very good. Yeah. Okay, very good. Well, anyway, we are here to discuss some very useful research that the Japanese Standard Center has done together with IFREC, and I give the floor first to Michael.
Yes. Okay. Yes. Thank you. Yes. A few months ago, you asked us if we would gather some information about the levels of goodwill and other relevant information that would be useful for informing you as this project on goodwill and impairment develops, and both the ASBJ and FRAG asked if they could contribute and to our work in this area. So they've very kindly undertaken quite a lot of research, gathering data on a number of different jurisdictions around the world. So today we've got Nobu Kawanishi and Filippo Poli, who are on the video in Tokyo, and we've got Philippe Alves here at the table in London. Filippo and Philippe, obviously, as you probably know, are both staff from FRAG, and Nobu is a board member with the ASBJ. So maybe if I could hand over straight away to Nobu and Filippo.
Okay, thank you very much. Thank you for the opportunity to present this data. Just a little bit of an opening statement. We at FRAG started to develop this analysis because we had a discussion in our board a few months ago, and my board felt that they needed some quantitative data in order to have a more informed debate. So they asked us to develop this analysis, and we're happy to share it with you. But just one thing, this analysis has not yet been shared neither with my technical expert group nor with the board. So in any case, don't take anything I may say today as a NEFRAG view or position or suggestion. And I think this is also holds true for the SBJ as well.
Yes.
Okay. Well, first of all, we can move to slide number one in the presentation. And this slide tells you the sample we looked at. So we took approximately 1,000 companies from the S&P in the US, the European S&P 350, the Nikkei, and the Australian market. And the first interesting data is that if you look at the total goodwill, there is a very high concentration, meaning that if you just take a limited number of companies, they carry already 50% of the total goodwill. And we did a similar exercise also for Europe on the total listed companies, which are a couple of thousand. And also in this case, if you just take a couple of tens companies, you would end up already with approximately 50% of the total goodwill. One thing in this presentation, we focused on goodwill. In some cases, we will present you some ratio calculated using the total intangibles. What we couldn't do was to isolate goodwill and other intangibles purchased from a business combination, simply because in the commercial database we use, we cannot make this distinction. So when we refer to intangibles, we mean the total intangible assets of companies. If we move to slide number four, here you have the trend of the total goodwill in the period between 2007 and 2014. As you can see, the U.S. has a continuous upward trend in the total goodwill. For Europe, the difference between 2007 and 2014 is approximately 13%. But if you look between 2010 and 2014, the total is reasonably stable. And this is mostly a combination of the fact that we had significant impairment charges in the European market, and we had less acquisitions. The data stops at 2014. I personally would be interested to see what is the trend for 2015, because for if you see for Europe, for instance, there was a significant increase. So it would be interesting to see if this trend continues. For the Australia market and the Nikkei market, and of course I should start to say that on the Nikkei market, most companies still amortize goodwill. The numbers are pretty much stable over time. If we move to the following slide, this slide basically shows you what is the trend in the average goodwill per company. And again, for US and for Europe, we have significantly larger numbers for both markets. And again, for the American market, you can see an upward trend. So the average goodwill per company steadily increases, while for the European market is, I would say, reasonably stable over the 7-year period. And then I will let Nobu continue. Yes.
On slide 6, we show the trend in the ratio of goodwill over net assets, which is the book value of total equity. The U.S. and Europe showed higher ratios, and the average during 2007 and 2014 was 34% for the U.S. and 31% for Europe. And the ratio for Japan was modest and steady with an average of 4%. The ratio for Australia was in the middle, being different from the modest figures of average goodwill per company shown in the earlier slides. The ratio for Europe and Australia decreased gradually during the period due to the relatively higher increase in net assets. In the next slide, slide 7, we did a similar analysis for intangibles, including goodwill. The trend in the ratio of intangibles over net assets was similar to the trend in goodwill over net assets. For this ratio, Europe, which averaged 51%, showed slightly higher figures than the U.S., which averaged 49%. Both intangibles and net assets increased in a similar manner for Japan, resulting in little movement in the ratio. Moving on to slide 8. Slide 8 shows the trend in the ratio of goodwill over market capitalization, which is the market value of total equity. The goodwill to market capitalization ratio showed more volatility compared to the goodwill to net assets ratio, mainly due to the volatility in market capitalization. The US and Europe showed higher figures than Japan and Australia, but the figures were less outstanding than the goodwill to net assets ratio. In slide 9, we did a similar analysis for intangibles, including goodwill. The trend in the ratio of intangibles over market capitalization was similar to the trend in the ratio of goodwill over market capitalization. Moving on to slide 10. Slide 10 shows the number of companies that recognize goodwill or intangibles exceeding 50% of net assets or market capitalization in 2014. The first table compares goodwill against net assets and market capitalization. For example, for the U.S. index, 155 out of 443 companies had goodwill exceeding 50% of their net assets, and 64 out of 443 companies had goodwill exceeding 100% of their net assets. The number in the more than 50% column includes those companies shown in the more than 100% column. Similarly, for the U.S. index, 13 out of 443 companies had goodwill exceeding 50% of their market capitalization, and 1 out of 443 companies had goodwill exceeding 100% of its market capitalization. The second table compares intangibles, including goodwill, against net assets and market capitalization in the same manner. Quite a number of companies in the U.S. and Europe recognize goodwill or intangibles exceeding 100% of their net assets, and some companies recognize goodwill or intangibles exceeding 100% of their market capitalization. Moving on to slide 11. Slides 11 and 12 show the trend in the breakdown of market capitalization. The total of yellow, green, and blue represent the market capitalization. Green represents goodwill, and yellow represents net assets other than goodwill. The total of green and blue represents net assets, and the yellow represents the difference between net assets and the market capitalization. In slide 11, we can see that for the US and Europe, a large portion of market capitalization, that is the market value of equity, was not recognized in the statement of financial position. And the fluctuation in market value affected the unrecognized value, or the yellow portion, rather than goodwill. And if you look at slide 12, the next slide, we can see that compared to the United States and Europe and Australia, Japan has much less unrecognized value, and fluctuations in market value affected recognized assets other than goodwill, rather than goodwill. So I'll let Filippo take on the other side. Yes.
Yes. In the following two slides, what we have done, we have started to do some of this same analysis by industry. In the database, it is possible to break down the sample using the standard classification Jigsaw 10 industry. And I'm not going to comment on each of the data, but you can see that there is a large difference between different industries in the sample, especially if you take a look at slide 14, where we have calculated the ratio goodwill to net assets. For instance, you can see that in the US market, the ratio may range between 7% for the energy sector to 100% for telecommunication. In Europe, you have 5% for energy, 65% for consumer staples. And also in Australia, you have 6.9 for materials and 117 for information technology. And when we looked at these numbers, that's why we thought that probably this analysis is more meaningful if it's broken down at the industry level. And on the last slide, we're going to have some suggestion for future direction for the quantitative analysis. On slide 15, you can see the number of the companies within the sample that have recognized the goodwill impairment and amortization for the Japanese sample during the period. And you can see that the number of companies that have recognized impairment losses in US, Europe, or Australia is relatively small. We have a bit higher number for Europe, approximately 30% of companies in the sample in each year recognize an impairment loss. We have definitely lower number for the US and for Australia.
Okay, I'd like to add one thing to this slide. Japanese accounting standards have consistently required the amortization of goodwill, and therefore, in theory, the ratio in the second table should be 100%. Because of the way we extracted the data from the database, the figures were less than 100%. But for 2014, we went into the annual reports of all the companies in this index and confirmed that the ratio was indeed 100%. And some entities had disclosed that their amortization expense was not presented as a separate line item because the amount was immaterial. I'd like to move on to slide 16. Slide 16 and 17 show the trend in the amounts of goodwill impairment and acquisition and other changes. In preparing these charts, we first gathered the figures for the impairment amounts shown in blue. Impairment amounts include the amount amortized for the Japanese index. The difference between the net change in goodwill during the period and the impairment amounts are shown in green as acquisition and other changes. This amount may include increases in goodwill from new acquisitions, as well as changes in the foreign exchange rates used to translate the goodwill amounts. In the US, the amount of goodwill impairment was smaller than the amounts of acquisitions and other changes, resulting in continuous increases in the goodwill balance. In 2012 and 2013, the decrease in the goodwill balance in Europe was due to fewer acquisitions and higher impairment charges. The recovery in 2014 was due to significant new acquisition and lower impairment charges. In slide 17, For Japan, impairment and amortization was relatively stable, resulting in modest changes in the goodwill balance. In Australia, relatively large impairment charges were recognized in 2011 and 2012, resulting in decreases in the goodwill balance. Moving on to slide 18. Slide 18 shows the implicit life of goodwill. The chart on the left shows the ratio of goodwill over the goodwill balance of the previous year end. For the US and Europe, the ratio ranged from 1% to 5%. For Japan, which includes amortization expenses in the numerator, was higher and ranged from 7 to 10%. We calculated the implicit life of goodwill by taking the inverse of the ratio. For the year of 2014, the implicit life was 11.4 years for the Japanese index and more than 70 years for the other indices. And after we submitted this presentation to the ISB, some have asked us to calculate the implicit life of goodwill based on the average from 2007 and 2014. And based on our calculation, the implicit life would be 12 years for the Japanese index, 72 years for the US, 33 years for Europe, and 27 years for Australia.
Okay. Well, in the last slide, what we did, we compared the trend of the total goodwill impairments and the trend in the stock index. So you have the blue columns, they represent the amount of goodwill impairment charges, and the red lines show the trend of the relative index. Now, I don't want to say to use words like correlation because they have a very precise meaning, but there seem to be, to a certain extent, a certain similarity, meaning that when you have a downward movement in the stock index, you have an increase also on impairment charge. But this is only partial because, for instance, in 2012, you can see there has been an improvement. Doesn't seem to explain the 2012 increase on the goodwill impairment. So I think that personally, this chart needs to be better analyzed. And that's why, for instance, for the European market, we have started to look into the industry breakdown of this analysis. And so we come to the last slide where we have suggested a few next steps. The first, as I said, since clearly there is a significant variation across the industries, we think that it would be useful to duplicate this analysis in terms both of absolute and relative weight of goodwill and intensity of impairment. And after, it would be interesting to see if we can justify these differences due to the different characteristic and economic cycles of the specific industry.
Yes, and another step might be to study some large M&A transactions and see if there's any difference based on the type of consideration paid, for example, cash and shares, and the type of intangible assets that were recognized. And that concludes our presentation, and we'll be happy to take any questions you may have.
Well, thank you for this very interesting work and presentation. Well, before I give my own observations, let me ask the staff, let me ask the board if they have questions or comments. Philippe.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Nobu. Thank you, Filippo. This is absolutely superb work. I have a question on slide 15, and I will compare to some work I've done for the my sample, which was the 40 companies CAC 40 index in France, which, by the way, is included in your sample of S&P Europe. How many of those companies which recognize goodwill impairment were kind of repetitive impairment for the same companies? Because we have an impression that in Europe, 30% of companies did recognize impairments during the period. If I look at a smaller sample of my 40 companies, and I take a period which begins in 2007, like you, my ending period is 1 year after because I did update the data until the end of 2015. And what I find is that out of the 40 companies in my sample, only 20, maximum 20, did recognize impairments in total. 50%, but only maybe one-third had material impairments. And the difference are immaterial, some amounts of impairment. But this is in aggregate for the 8 years during the period, which means that the other 50% did not recognize any impairment. So there is a concentration of impairments among a limited or relatively limited number of companies. So it may be that in your number of companies that recognize impairments every year, it might be the same companies which have successive impairment charges. Mm-hmm. Have you had any chance to investigate?
I cannot reply to the question with exact numbers. I think in general terms, it is true there is a high concentration of goodwill and there is also a high concentration of impairment. I wouldn't be surprised if some of the companies in the sample pass impairment losses in different years, but that's something we have not checked, so I'll just write it down and we will control it.
Wait, what?
Noble, I feel very interesting and have one question about what is the reason why the Japanese companies on average or any other the some terms the goodwill is relatively lower. And can we look at the page 4? No. Page 4, if we compare the US market and Japanese market, the total goodwill in US market the last year is 2,149 and Japanese is only 10. As I understand, I forgot exactly, the market capitalization of US market is about 2 times of US, Japanese market. I forgot exact number. But on aggregate, the Japanese companies, the goodwill is much less than US market, the goodwill. And I guess there are two possible reasons. I want to know what the major reason. One is when the Japanese company took over other companies, they have much less overpayment. That results in much less goodwill. Alternatively, the reason might be the Japanese company or less Japanese company grow through
acquisition.
Yeah. They mainly expand through internal development. Yeah. And Noble, can you answer my question roughly?
Yes, generally speaking, many Japanese companies grow internally. And whenever they do buy companies, they don't pay a lot over the net assets. So they start with having very small amount of goodwill. And in addition to that, the Japanese companies that are included here all actually amortize goodwill based on Japanese GAAP, and therefore the amount is lower than if it were not amortized. So those would be the two reasons why the goodwill amount would be lower.
Can I just jump in there? Can I add a third possible reason?
Yes.
Which is, if you have a look on slide 12, essentially what slide 12 seems to be showing to me is that the unrecognized value in Japanese companies is also a lot lower than the unrecognized companies. And if that unrecognized value is in part a reflection of the unrecognized goodwill, it just suggests that there is less goodwill overall floating around in the Japanese market at the moment.
Yes. That I think is one of the reasons, yes. Some Japanese companies have a lower ROA than the companies in other markets.
I think the comparison, for me, the biggest eye-opener were a couple of eye-openers. First of all, I found it remarkable the stability of goodwill as a percentage of total market cap and net assets, which, after all the indications that we have had that there was a huge reservoir of goodwill building up, waiting to burst, that doesn't seem to be the case. The only comment I would like to make with that of course this was during a period of pretty severe economic crisis, especially in Europe, so that may have been a bit of an abnormal period with relatively a lot of impairment. But secondly, and that has in itself little to do with our question, but the enormous differences in unrecognized value between the United States, Europe, and Japan is just mind-boggling. Apparently, the markets, the expectations of cash flows in Japan are much lower than in America. America has more unrecognized value than Europe. I can understand, given the situation of their respective economies, but it is quite stark.
Can I jump in here? Another observation,
and you may want to test it. If you compare by industry sector the concentration of intangibles on goodwill in percentage to net value, you will find, for instance, the information technology for the Tech 40 index, 96% of net book value is composed of intangibles on goodwill. But if you look at the market cap, unrecognized amount, then the price to book ratio, which is the unrecognized goodwill, is also very high. And it seems that overall, and this is again not an absolute correlation, the more goodwill and intangibles are recognized on the books, the more the market will add extra valuations, unrecognized goodwill. Which is a bit surprising.
Isn't it the other way around?
It should be, but it's not. But it's
the more unrecognized value there is in companies, the more they have to pay in the markets. And the more goodwill there will
the
be created.
It's the question of the other way around. Yeah, well, the question is, you could assume that the more is already recognized, the less needs to be recognized on top of it. Mm-hmm. And what you find is exactly the opposite. The more is already recognized, the more you will find extra.
No, it's very logically connected. When you take over a company in a situation where the market expectations are very rosy and there is a lot of unrecognized value, of course there's automatically going to be a lot of goodwill.
Well,
I don't find that surprising.
We could investigate further that and whether it is true on all the markets. And because I was a bit surprised at first instance, and the correlation is not always true, but it seems to be pretty much, if you look at the curves and tables, it is visible.
Chang-Wu, thank you very much. Yes, I would like to say great thank you for your joint efforts to share this kind of a nice, excellent numbers and the quantitative data, so really thank you for that. However, can I make some kind of a suggestion to make this quantitative analysis be more useful? You'd better put some kind of a questions we are discussing now, for example, too little. Or too late, that means you know, impairment amount is too little, that means goodwill or intangible is overstated, such kind of issue. Another one is too late, whether these numbers or tables are supporting that issue, such kind of thing. But based on your analysis, I have found out some kind of very positive or constructive a kind of evidence of this kind of question, not directly, but indirectly. For example, you know, if you see page 18, and in the case of Nikkei companies, their average year of their goodwill is about 11 years. However, in the case of S&P, American companies, it takes 130 years. To maybe for their goodwill to disappear on balance sheet. So this is a kind of a indirect evidence of whether their impairment recognition is too little or appropriate or late. So that is one example. So maybe you know we can see many treasurer's numbers here in your study, but it's not easy to getting those numbers to support our you know, issues and discussions. So that's one thing. Another thing is, this is a very minor thing, but we talked about unrecognized value. If you see the page 12, in the case of DK, there are some negative numbers, you know, in DK. So this is not a unrecognized value. This is a kind of, a, in a sense, we might say the book value of all kinds of Japanese companies may be overstated. However, very interesting thing is, you know, DK companies, you know, they are using amortization method, so they are to eliminate their goodwill. You know, just it takes us the 11 years of comparing very short time, eliminating every goodwill. Even though, still, there are book value of Japanese companies, I don't know which one is right. The market price is right, or their book value of their companies right. I don't know. However, this is a very peculiar observation that's quite different from their SMPK and SMP. So these studies are very, very interesting. You know, another maybe I could say, you said the industry classification. In the case of their IT, they have very small amount of equity. However, in the case of financial industry, they do have a very big, large equity. So, with this kind of very two numbers, quite difficult to compare each other, financials and IT. But we are saying you are suggesting some kind of conclusion that is a IT company has a big good deal relatively to their small number or small amount of equity. So this kind of thing is maybe you if you consider more carefully then the tables and the analysis of yours will be very, very helpful to us to make a very good decision. Thank you very much.
Japan is another good example since book value is so close to market value. When you have a takeover there, automatically there's almost going to be no goodwill creation. And you can see that in the numbers, you know, on page 17, at the most it's like 8 billion in 2012. In Europe it's 100 billion, in the United States close to 150 billion. It's very logical.
Thank you. Exactly the point Hans raised. In the case of Japanese market, there is no unrecognized value. So therefore, even if you acquire the company, there wouldn't be a much goodwill. Whereas if you go to the S&P market, those company has a huge unrecognized value, then automatically it goes to goodwill. However, I think this is the kind of mechanism of value creation, I would say, that bubble creation, danger of bubble creation, because we are talking about PHA, pre-acquisition headroom accounting. So even if you acquire some company which has a goodwill, if you have your own goodwill inside, then you can hide the amortization or impairment with your own goodwill to offset against the real impairment. So eventually, to the outside world, no impairment is happening. So therefore, it will be piled up another goodwill. So then it goes to the unrecognized things as well. So if there are many companies who is keep growing with the method of merger and acquisition, and if the market is rosy and the share price is keep going up, then you can do it. You can grow by acquiring new company without recognizing any goodwill. However, once the situation changed, then it will cause a procyclical impairment. So I feel that some of the danger of our mechanism. So I think our PHA approach would work for this situation. That is the one observation I found. And the second point is whether or not the level of goodwill is stable or not. I think, you know, we say that level of goodwill is relatively stable compared to the market cap or net assets. However, as I said before, if you didn't recognize impairment, and then automatically it would be incorporated into the net asset, and also it is incorporated to the market cap as well. So even if you say that it's stable relative to the net asset or market cap, it does not necessarily mean the, you know, goodwill itself is stable. Because if you look at the page 10, I feel, you know, it's quite dangerous that if you look at S&P, so out of 143, 155 companies have more than 50% of net wealth, net asset, 50% value of goodwill against the net asset. And the 64 companies have more than net asset. And I think it's kind of a dangerous situation. Even if overall level of goodwill looks stable, when it comes to some particular industry or some particular company, they have this situation. And 64 companies has more than net asset. I think it's a bit dangerous. I wouldn't say it's stable. And that's the second observation. And the third observation is whether or not impairment is too little or too late. And if you look at the page 19, actually it seems like when the economy go down, the impairment loss increases. So that indicates that it is not too late. However, I'm not quite sure the amount itself is sufficient or not. So, but only by looking at this chart, we could say they pick up the impairment timely basis. However, if the those company who actually picked up the impairment timely basis, the number itself is small, it does not mean the we can't say it's too late or or not sufficient. So the reason why I'm skeptical to this chart on page 19 is because if you look at the page 18, so even if they recognize the impairment, if we multiply it into the how many years needed to amortize everything, then it takes 130 years. So it's just on 2014, but even if you average it, it's about 70 or 80. So 80 years. So that means I wouldn't say it's sufficient. So even if we can say some companies picks up impairment timely, but you cannot say that it's sufficient impairment. And actually, if you look at page 15, the number of companies who actually recognize the goodwill is quite small, especially in US market. And this is because their capital market itself is quite rosy. They have a huge amount of unrecognized value in the as a form of pre-acquisition headroom. So therefore, automatically, they cannot recognize impairment. So overall, as a mechanism, you know, impairment only method has a, you know, huge dangerous structure. That is my impression from this quantitative analysis.
Mary?
One observation, you know, like talk perhaps thinking of some of the issues we've been wrestling with, and maybe inspired by yesterday's discussion about conceptual framework. If you look at slide 17 in particular, and I look at the Nikkei index, you have relatively consistent, the blue boxes, relatively consistent levels of impairment and amortization. And yet when you think about that economic period, to me, relatively stable levels of impairment imply relatively consistent economic circumstances. And to me, if I think about representationally faithful, I don't know that stability in the period of huge not only market swings, but also economic expectations, is as representationally faithful as, if you look back on slide 16, seeing very lumpy, blue profile of the blue. So again, add to the thanks that others have expressed for some numbers that, we have to look at them and say, what are they telling us, and, is what the numbers telling us consistent with our view of what was happening in the period? Very, very helpful to have data. That was just the one that I happen to focus on in terms of thinking about what do the numbers say is happening and what do we think was happening in that time period.
Mary, on that point, slide number 8 in the bottom right-hand corner shows us the market capitalization movement across the years for each of the indices, and none of them, they all look fairly similar. And so it's interesting that you make that observation about what the slide 17 was telling us, that perhaps, might suggest that there was a period of stability, and yet, compared with the other jurisdictions, and yet when you look at the market capitalization slide on slide 8, it says, no, that there wasn't a difference between the four different markets.
Right, and so I think it just is saying again that slide 17, the profile of recognition of expense that you see with Nikkei makes me scratch my head and say, is this reflecting what's actually going on?
But Mary, this is two elements, amortization and impairment.
Right.
Amortization most likely is stable over time. You apply 10%.
Well, I think that's the point you're making.
But the extra bit, which is variable, is impairment, isn't distinguished between
them. Right, and I accept that. And I'm not questioning whether the requirements were applied appropriately.
Oh, okay.
What I'm saying is the consequence of having an amortization model makes every period look the same when economically they are not.
Well, say 2010, probably there was something like 2 billion, and 2014, 4 billion, or a bit more, so double. Maybe the amortization charge was 2 billion stable, and there is only 2 billion of impairment, which makes a big difference, although it doesn't show because the scale of the table doesn't show it very well. So it would be interesting to find out for Japan how much of the charge was amortization, recurring, and how much was impairment on top of amortization, if that is possible.
Yeah, and you're right, there may be both scale issues and the fact that there's relatively less goodwill may impact it. But yet, when I step back and say macro observation, if I only had data about impairment, I would say there's a lot more stability in the economic performance of the companies in the Nikkei versus, for example, in the Australian index. And I'm not sure, given the periods that these are covering, that's a fair reflection.
Darrell?
So I'd agree with everybody else. I think this has been very useful to actually see the data, and I'm not going to add too much more. Well, I'm not going to repeat what others have said, other than to say I agree with Mary that I found the differences on slide 16 and 17 in terms of what I would see as information content, understanding what has happened in that market. It jumps out quite a bit. The other little surprises for me, to an extent, were on slide 15. So to an extent, we seem to have heard in the past that people not much impairment happening. So particularly if you look at Europe and Australia, there seems to be a fairly significant amount of impairment activity happening. I think what would be interesting to understand is whether there is some underlying fundamental that makes the S&P index different to everybody else, or whether that is because of differences in the impairment accounting.
Oh, just the economy doing a lot better.
It would be interesting to know whether that's in fact the case, because it's markedly different. And is that the case because you would assume under the economy doing better that they're also paying more for the good? Is there some difference in our impairment test that is driving that, or is it purely what you say?
If you look at page 8, market cap development, we see that Europe went from 100 to 60, 108, and then to back to a little bit over 100. In the meantime, the US went to 140. It's a clear reflection of economic development.
So that was interesting. On slide 19, and I think this was picked up by Tuck as well, what was interesting for me on that slide is other than 2008, where you had, because of what was happening in the economy, possibly a little bit of a chance to kitchen sink, to say, well, just take the losses and be done with them. In every other case where there was a drop in the market, you seem to have a lag effect. The goodwill only starts to get written off in years after the drop, when the market started to recover. Now, that might be me stretching the data way beyond what's there. But I thought that looked interesting in context of people saying that there might be too little too late. And then the last thing I thought, just to say that I think the idea of being able to split this down and look at it on a more generic industry type basis, I think is going to be very useful. I think that would be very helpful. And one other question is, I just wondered what format this data is available in, and whether it is now accessible for people just to have a look at and get a better feel for it.
Miguel?
So I tried to compare page 6, 11 and 12 to the past capture value with the industry-based analysis on page 13. I feel the next step, it is quite important to have industry-based analysis, particularly the telecom and information technology industry. And because in these areas, you know, there will be significant goodwills and difference between market value and net asset. And more importantly, I think, in my view, when we investigate the industry-based data, particularly in IT, telecom industry, we also should have the case study means to analyze a particular company. The reason why is because, for example, the telecom industry. If you ask whether Google should impair, people may say, no, why? You know, the company grows so well. There's no indications. But on the other hand, in the same industry, Yahoo recently faced problems. And if Yahoo, in the past few years, never recognized any impairment, and suddenly, you know, the company may disappear. And we feel, just like impairment for financial industry, we feel, you know, there will be problems. And so, you know, my suggestion is we should have a further in-depth analysis of some industries, because the of the slide shows, particularly in U.S. markets, the goodwill are so concentrated in a few companies, over 100%, Taka mentioned. I expect, you know, I guess the it's mainly in the IT industries, like Google, Apple, and others. And in manufacturing industry, I don't expect a huge amount of unrecognized value. So industry-based study plus a few case analysis will give us more insights.
Amaro.
Thanks, Ms. Like others have already said, I think it's an excellent starting point in terms of identifying the origins of goodwill. I really like it. And I guess two things that I had in my in mind, and apart from all the slides that I already were mentioned, I think slide 18 should be the one of the key aspects of next steps, because after understanding the origin of goodwill, looking at markets as we have, and there is a reasonable perception that why goodwills are so relevant in the U.S. I think we had to go to the why, and the why is first, why are the average life in terms of years so significantly distinct between markets, particularly Europe. I would mention now Europe and the U.S. So relevant markets, and I am I think I would expect for the next step, since you are doing the study, a little bit on the lag effect that Dario mentioned, because this is one of the things that we've been hearing most frequently, the market reaction or the too little too late on the impairment side. So as Weigu suggested, after analyzing the industries, going to few individual case studies to understand why impairment was recognized and what was the market reaction to that, to really confirm the impression or at least the assertion by many that markets do not react because they had already priced the impairment maybe months in advance or sometime in advance or 1 year in advance. I think this is, to me, the key aspect to really assess if impairment is the appropriate mechanics or methodology or not. If the impairment is better compared to what we had before or what we have in Japan. So I think it's an excellent origin identification, and the next steps I would suggest to explore the aspect of market reaction.
Gary?
Thank you. A few incremental comments that I think I can make them mostly off page 15. Is I'm sort of where kind of where Daryl was going on it. When you look at one thing that would be useful to know is what's the duration from the time you record goodwill to your first impairment charge. And again, if it's 3 years after the fact, I think you might have a different accounting solution if it's 15. I think evidence or work that the staff had brought in sort of implied 2 to 4 years is sort of the rough range of which impairments become evident after an acquisition closes, but I'm not 100% sure I recall that correct, but I think how long after the fact they first manifest themselves, I think, is an important factor to know. Because if it is 15 or 20 years, I think it leans you more towards, well, maybe it should be more of either a much more robust impairment test, or you should be thinking more strongly about amortization. If it's 2 to 4 years, I think it's a very different approach towards it. When I look at the U.S. versus Europe here, actually, I think the fact that your comment that the U.S. market's just doing better, I don't think that really quite explains this. I mean, you got roughly 25% of the European companies per year having an impairment charge, and about 7 or 8% of the U.S. companies. I mean, if I was looking, studying this, or looking, we're talking to FASB about this project. If the FASB was not likely, if they did not decide to make material changes to their impairment test, with a 130-year average implied duration of goodwill, they're going to be looking more towards amortization. I mean, it would be how I would draw a conclusion out of this, and yes, time will tell. So as you look at the chart on the bottom of page 15, is the international companies are in very different spots in terms of the percentage of impairment or the amount of impairment than the U.S. So you could see us staying with an impairment type approach and them perhaps shifting more towards amortization type approach. I think we need to understand, you know, why is only 6, 7, 8% of their companies having impairment a year and more like 25 or 35% of the international companies? Whether it's the difference in the impairment tests, whether it's explained by market factors, but I think we need to understand why the results so anomalous.
Can you give me the name of one internet giant that is located in Europe?
No, maybe not. But to give you some media companies that are located in Europe that are got equally ugly charts for goodwill in Europe.
I'd like to reiterate the thanks that others have given for the DASRA. I think it's very helpful for us to look at this. Having said that, I think the tricky thing with this is there's so much combination of economic factors going on with accounting factors. I think we need to be careful because sometimes it's quite hard to unpick those. And one of the things, I guess, where I, to give an example of that, is this ratio of goodwill to net assets. I don't know whether that's good or bad or what that tells me, because I think some of those differences surely must be driven by how acquisitive different companies have been and the environment in which they've made the acquisitions, and also just how high the leverage ratios of companies are. So it could look very high just because it's a highly geared company, rather than telling us too much about the goodwill and particularly about its accounting. And then I just wanted to follow up just on a couple of comments that others have made. And while I think it's sort of interesting to know how soon after an acquisition somebody might have impaired, unless I know more about the facts and circumstances, I don't know whether 2 to 4 years is too early, too late, or just right, because I don't know what the right time was for a particular acquisition. I don't think just because it's early it's necessarily better, or just because it's at year 15 it's necessarily wrong, unless I know what's driving that. If I had a controlled experiment and I had the two same companies and one was impairing at year 2 and one was impairing at year 15, then yeah, that tells me something, but absent that, I'm not sure. Also, this point about the lag effect, I think it's interesting because it might tell us something about how good our triggers are, but also, if my recollection's correct, I think when we did the academic study, or we had the academic study presented to us, there was still seen to be benefit in the confirmatory value that impairment gives us. And I think it sort of ties into the good point that Mary made about the sort of picture of stability versus not. Even if the timing is sort of slightly off and it's confirmatory, it's still informative because it tells you it wasn't as stable as another period. So I think we just need to be a little bit careful with how much we read into those lag effects beyond the sort of trigger analysis.
Ian?
Yes, I mean, I reiterate everybody's comments on how valuable this is. I was just interested in the Japanese market because I was hoping to learn a bit of the effects of amortization, because that's the market that has. But there's obviously so many other things, and the market's so different from the other markets in the way it operates. If we're going to have 28% of the capitalization of the market's going to be under IFRS, and I don't know how many percent under US GAAP, approximately. So we say 50% of the market don't amortize at that stage, 50% do. So drawing conclusions on the effect of amortization by looking at the Japanese market, I think, is quite difficult.
Especially looking 5 years before, 5 years or 8 years before, we're not applying IFRS.
They're operating under four different standards.
Yeah, and changing in a period.
And Ian, with regards to the Nikkei information, that is only those applying Japanese GAAP that is shown.
Okay.
Slide 3
makes
that note.
That is helpful. And I'd just kind of reiterate a bit what Sue said. You know, we've got a kind of an assumption going around here, I think, that more impairment is good, less impairment is bad.
Well, perhaps I can make a comment that's close to what Ian just said. First, yesterday we had a meeting with people from E&Y who are looking very carefully at the relevance of financial reporting as it is now. And one of the stats that they came up with was developments of value of net assets relative to market capitalization, and they showed a percentage of that it had been reduced from close to 80% 10 or 15 years ago to not much more than 80% in the United States right now. Now, that number doesn't seem to be borne out by page 11, where when I make the rough calculation, even in the United States, where unrecognized value is the highest, the net assets plus goodwill is still about 40% of the total value of a company. Still much lower than, of course, the market cap, but not so stark. So perhaps you could talk to EY, and we will provide you with the numbers that they showed to see what are the differences. Nevertheless, if there was no recognition of good at all, or it would gradually disappear over the years, then this contrast between market cap and net asset value would even be starker. The relevance of the balance sheet would perhaps even become less so than currently is the case. That's also something to be kept in mind. Mm-hmm. Mary.
A quick supplement, thinking about Daryl's comment about both industry and follow-up, and I think it said if either we or we were to ask somebody else to do some further work and follow-up, and that's an if, I think it would be interesting to pick the financial sector because, again, thinking about what we know about the economy in that period, I think it would be relevant to make a comparison of Europe and U.S., remembering that it's goodwill and intangibles rather than loan portfolios that are being impaired. I think we could get more insight into Daryl's question about is it differences in impairment methodology, because I think those are circumstances in which we know that sector in both economies was significantly under pressure at the same time. And it also would help maybe to get some sense of the scale of whether the overall numbers are being skewed by financial sector. Just looking at the data in these slides, you can see the average goodwill and intangibles per company, but you can't tell what proportion of the index is in that sector. So that's one that may help if we were to pick a sector.
I think analysis without the financials should be done excluding financials, because any ratio for the financials is very strange.
Well,
very odd.
It depends. It depends on whether the financials are 5 out of 500 or 50 out of 500.
But they represent a significant proportion of the market index in Europe. I don't know for Japan, for Australia, I don't know for the US, but for Japan, the financials represent a significant weight in the index.
Yeah. Sure. Martin?
Yeah, only two comments, man. I really found page 18 very interesting, which is the implicit life of the then for European and S&P market is some 70 years. That is really what I think when is whatever goodwill is, but if something is lasting 70 years in this fast changing environment, it's a little bit troublesome. And secondly, I would repeat also what Sue said, because I think this data, and I agree with Hans, is not showing what I have seen maybe from some similar studies in Germany, that okay, the bubble is, goodwill bubble is growing. But this is impacted by a lot of economic factors, but also when we see, okay, how different is in different industries, I think it is also impacted by that. You can also see, okay, that especially in Europe, there was also years of really less acquisition M&A activity, so I can, several factors, and it would be really interesting if we maybe would have the same data maybe for a specific industry like the telecommunication or which have a high level of goodwill and a high level of M&A activity. And I think we have really to further analyze this data before we draw in conclusions. But at least, as I said, the concern which I have is this number, which is 70 years of average lifetime of goodwill.
Yeah, but that was also a bit of an outlier. The average number was already a lot higher.
Yeah, but
that was 72
for the
S&P. For the
S&P. You have to be careful when you look at this table on page 18. There is a rollover. There is a continuous replenishment. So this tank of goodwill is being emptied by impairments or amortization, is being filled in by new M&A. And there's a permanent wave of new goodwill getting into that box. So the average level of the tank might be stable over time, maybe increasing slightly because of the new M&A activity. And this is a first in, first out kind of approach. And I think we do not see it because we don't see how many new M&A, as much M&A has added new goodwill to this amount in the recent years.
Thank you, dear. I would like to suggest to include the Aztec analysis you have made already, because in the reason why I'm saying is Vigo and Martin and some other board members said IT industry and telco industry might have some kind of some peculiar unique phenomenon on this kind of thing. So you said there you have done analysis on this NASDAQ company, so please provide that result, then maybe you might get a better idea on this kind of industry effect.
Aren't the big NASDAQ companies included in the S&P 500? Are they completely excluded?
Yes.
They are excluded or they are included?
They are included.
Included, so they are already in.
Yes. No, you said in your paper, you said in the footnote 1 on page 2 of the paper, your appendix, you said the AASQ also collected and analyzed the data for the NASDAQ 100 and some other companies and markets. But you said that.
Yes. So what we did was we analyzed the S&P index and we also analyzed the NASDAQ index. But the S&P 500 already includes certain number of NASDAQ companies.
Uh-huh. Okay.
So there was a duplication and therefore we took out the NASDAQ index.
Nobu, can I ask one simple question?
Hold on. Peter first.
I've got a question for Nobu and it's a two-part question. So for... Yes. Japan, you had difficulty distinguishing impairment from amortization. And so my first part of the question is, was that because the companies don't provide the data, or is it because the data provider doesn't provide it, or is it because they don't provide it in a format that's very easy to use and would be very labor-intensive to use? And the second part of the question is, if the companies are providing it, but the data providers either aren't providing it or aren't summarizing it in a convenient form, that's presumably because they think the users aren't interested in that disaggregation. And that surprises me because you would expect impairment and amortization to have very different properties. And so I just wondered if you have any comments, if it is that they feel the users aren't really interested in that split,
yeah,
why that might be.
To answer your first question, the major reason is that we just mechanically went through the database to get the numbers, and when we do that, we in many cases looked at the cash flow statement to see the adjustment, and whenever they make that adjustment, they combine both the amortization and impairment. But if you do look into the individual annual reports of the companies, they do split the numbers. But we didn't go through each company to do that in this analysis. So I think there is a difference between that information content and the amount of amortization and amount of goodwill impairment.
Right, but that implies that you found it quite difficult to split the information. You would need to do a lot of work to do it, which implies the data providers aren't providing it in a format that's easy to use.
That is correct, yes.
Well, and also the informational value of impairment is not so high in Japan. There's not much point in.
Well, that seems to be implying that that there isn't much information content there, or that the users think of it as the same as amortization, or think of amortization as the same as.
There's not much to begin with, and what is there is being amortized. Wait, Bob?
No, very simple question. Whether S&P 400 include Chinese company?
Maybe, but they are not.
The reason why I'm asking is because nearly all of the major Chinese IT company, telecom company listed in U.S. market, including Alibaba and others.
And banks.
Not banks.
I'm sorry, I don't have the list with me right now, but I'll go back and check.
Okay, thank you.
Two questions or observations for follow-up, guys. The first deals with how many of the companies in this index were essentially acquisitions of private equity firms that eventually then went public, for which you have public data. So a company goes private by an acquisition by XYZ company, a very significant levered price is paid, it's private for 3 or 4 years and then goes public as an exit strategy. I'd be interested in knowing how many of those companies comprise this population, because I think it could influence some of the motivations behind goodwill impairment in terms of when it's taken, the timing of it. The second thing is, and this relates to an observation I've been giving to Michelle on a number of occasions, if you look at goodwill by industry on slide 13, it doesn't come as any surprise to see where it's concentrated. Typically, industries that are going through a consolidation phase, and telecommunications is really, I guess, the poster child there, for the reasons that the industry is under kind of a secular, you know, paradigm shift, in that you have more and more companies looking to acquire customers, right? The prices that they're having to pay for those customers is relative to trying to gather them organically seem to be, you know, more efficient. But in general, the margins for those industries are not expanding, they're declining. And hence the reason why they want to consolidate. Healthcare is a classic example. In the United States, you look at the health insurance market. When I started following the market in 1993, 94, when the threat of the Clinton healthcare legislation was on the table, there might have been, I would say, 25 or 30 companies. Then all of a sudden, it shrunk to about 6 or 7. Today, you have some of the biggest health insurers coming together. It might be down to 3 now, you know, excluding the Blue Cross and Blue Shield companies. So industries that are under pressure will consolidate, and they will become big companies, and you will see large amounts of goodwill. Now, logic tells me the economics, if in fact margins are under pressure, that would argue for goodwill impairment. You're not expecting to earn excess returns in those kinds of situations, but yet, you know, you may have this kind of lag effect. So as Daryl said, you have a significant amount of goodwill being observed, but what isn't clear is whether or not it's timely. Well, that's the key issue.
I don't know if you de facto succeed in creating an oligopoly, which it seems to be the case in many parts of the American markets.
But it doesn't mean that you're earning excess returns, though. That's the whole definition of goodwill.
Lot of pricing part for the cloud.
Maybe. If the U.S. government, though, is a factor in telecommunications,
telecom charges are a lot higher in the United States.
That could be the issue, I think, is the regulation in these markets is having a significant effect on pricing.
Very little market regulation in the United States. Okay, well, you've heard many words of appreciation, and let me again echo that. This was really useful. This is the kind of analysis we really need to come to good decision making in the end. So we thank you very much, and of course we would welcome any follow-up analysis that you are still going to do. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Very much.